global issues. The meeting is also a source of controversy in other countries around the world, including South Korea, where activists at a Seoul forum slammed the event as diplomatic whitewashing.
This summit is a tool to conceal the terrible truth that countless Asian and Pacific people had to bleed due to 50 years of Japanese imperialism beginning in the late 19th century. It's a blindfold to cover Japan's hypocritical steps towards a nuclear-free world, peace, and rearmament, while dumping nuclear-contaminated water and scrapping its peace constitution.
South Korea's relations with Japan have always been controversial, but especially now as President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to improve ties against the wishes of many South Koreans, who demand an apology for what they call Japan's colonial abuses.
As world leaders flock to Hiroshima, South Koreans are reminded of a history the U.S. and Japan might rather forget. When the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, in addition to more than 200,000 Japanese, estimates suggest some 40,000 Koreans were killed. Many of them were forced laborers.
Some South Koreans say President Yoon is moving the country too close to the United States and a military alliance with Japan, which is seen as increasing regional tension. Japanese leader Fumio Kishida invited Yoon to the G7.
The South Korean government's participation is mainly to strengthen military cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, and further strengthen military cooperation with NATO, which is mainly led by the United States. If South Korea's participation in the G7 was to reinforce the military alliance as a benefit, that can never be a good thing for the peace of the Korean Peninsula, as well as world peace.
While the summit plans to address the Russia-Ukraine war and economic issues, activists also argue the rich G7 nations need to do more to solve the humanitarian crisis now unfolding in East Africa. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A new report by the Institute of Watson Brown on their Cost of War project, which evaluates the results of the post-9/11 wars on affected countries, says the post-9/11 wars have caused more than 4.5 million people to lose their life in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan. This study says that some of these people were killed in the war, but a larger number died indirectly due to the destructive effects of the war, which reaches 3.7 million people.
These mentioned casualties have different reasons. One is that the treatment centers have been destroyed due to war and medical aid seekers could not access treatment. Also, the widespread of diseases due to lack of health centers is countable. We can even refer to using bombs and weapons used in war that had environmental consequences that affected people. Overall destruction of infrastructures and long-term effects of the war is the main reason for casualties.
According to the report, tens of millions of people living in the war zones have also been displaced. The U.S. post-9/11 wars have forcibly displaced at least 38 million people in and from Afghanistan and the other mentioned countries.
Taking responsibility has three steps. First is to acknowledge they are the cause of this destruction and misery, which they don't. Second is ethical acceptance of the results of what they have done. And finally, there should be a higher power to compel them to take responsibility for what they have done. Some might say the UN is a higher power. Still, the UN is created by some countries which have the right or the veto right, and it shows flexibility towards these countries. There is simply no base on which these countries take responsibility.
The results of the war imposed by the U.S. on Afghanistan are the shocking numbers of 30% rise in food insecurity, 41% increase in children malnutrition and rising poverty, 1.5 million people left with disabilities and 2 million widows. Poverty, unemployment, and poor medical conditions are considered only some of the results of 20 years of U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. Despite the fact that the war is over, people are still facing challenges due to the effects of that war. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
A Industrial production in the EU's top economy, Germany, has suffered an unexpected decline. It's bad news for the entire bloc. However, a forecast published on Monday suggests the EU's economy is set to grow modestly. But downside risks are also growing.
Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine continues to cast a long shadow of uncertainty over the economy.
Grants to help struggling EU firms will soon be withdrawn, Eurozone finance ministers announced on Monday.
Companies that are receiving support will have to look at how they can support their own long-term viability.
A growing number of people are reaching the conclusion that the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine through constructive dialogue with Russia. The cost of living crisis resulting from the conflict is taking its toll.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful, but you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Apparently, financial markets are looking on nervously because so many things have been impacted by the war.
Due to the fact also of the uncertainties in China and lower exports and imports from China, and also due to the expectations of the economy in the United States.
A conference in Brussels on Monday heard that cracks are showing in the EU with respect to the war in Ukraine.
The Europeans have been united, but they need to be much more united.
Trade union members across the EU point out that wages are not keeping up with inflation as the bloc continues to spend billions of euro on arming Ukraine. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A great open-hearted and free-thinking Iranian poet, as described by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi in a message read to the audience by the Minister of Culture on the occasion of Persian Language Day. Credited for reviving the Persian language through his literary masterpiece Shahnameh or the Book of Kings, Hakim Abulqasim Ferdowsi is honored every year on the occasion. Persian or Farsi, as referred to by native speakers, is a branch of Indo-European languages. It is primarily spoken in Iran, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, but widely understood in Central Asia. It is considered a relatively simple language to learn grammatically. It is written from right to left using a modified version of the Arabic alphabet. The Saadi Foundation in Tehran has made it its mission to promote the Persian language, Farsi. And Persian Language Day is the best opportunity for that.
Farsi is the key to a treasure chest full of gold coins. Our literature and Persian poems are the treasure inside that chest. I recommend everyone to learn Farsi.
I fell in love with classic Persian literature through the Ferdowsi's Shahnameh. It took him over 3 decades to write the book at a time when Arabic was the main scientific and literary language of Iran.
Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings, recounts Iran's mythical and historical past. The book is considered valuable cultural heritage for Iranians, while it serves as a great inspiration to learn Farsi for foreigners.
Foreigners say Persian is one of the most beautiful languages in the world. Persian Language Day is celebrated on May 15th to honor the world-renowned Persian poet Ferdowsi and his masterpiece Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal university student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023.
Students should not drown themselves in the internet. While the internet does exist in the country, despite all the things that are said here and there, social media exists and the internet exists. Some people sit around waiting to be flooded with analysis, news, and content from the internet. That's wrong. You need to seize control of the social media. You should be the ones to direct it. Your thoughts, news, and analysis should go out on the internet, not the other way around. These are things that plague student activities. Sometimes caring, faithful students ask us what their duty is. Sometimes they write to me, or at times they come to our office and talk with our friends there. You can sense their concern and their willingness to do something. One of the important duties is to remove the impurities from important student activities, which are a great opportunity and something valuable for the country.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One more topic about students. I don't wish to answer your questions now with the things that I am saying. I mean, this is not what I'm trying to do now. I can't do this in this limited time. I want you to have a basis for your movement. In other words, organize your movement by looking at the long horizons ahead of you. You're seeking progress. The best youth in our country are mainly our university students. And new pious students want to move forward. I want this goal to be reached. Look at the distant horizon. They ask me, in your opinion, what is the duty of an ideal, ambitious student who is thinking about the future? This is my answer. The first thing is to bring about a change in the thinking and reality of your society, and then to bring about a change in the thinking and reality of the world. Does it surprise you that a student can change the reality of the world? It is not surprising at all. You are students today, but tomorrow, today's students will become directors in politics, and they will administer an important part of the country. The country's officials today used to be students like you, and now they are busy running the country's affairs. They are busy with managing the country's politics, economy, and diplomacy. Today's student is tomorrow's philosopher. He or she is tomorrow's researcher.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
With you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight. The Republican Party has lost contact with nearly all of the whistleblowers in their ongoing investigation into President Joe Biden. Marjorie Taylor Greene confirmed on Monday, 15th of May. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has covered this story and tells us more. The Republican Party has lost contact with nearly all of the whistleblowers in their ongoing investigation into President Joe Biden, Marjorie Taylor Greene confirmed on Monday, 15th of May. According to the Georgia Republican, most of the informants are missing in action, except for one. That whistleblower is very safe, Marjorie Taylor Greene told Steve Bannon on his War Room podcast. But he does fear for his life, and rightfully so. While Greene claims to be in touch with that one witness, the same can't be said for up to nine others. That whistleblower came through for us, thankfully, through the help of Senator Grassley, she said. But other whistleblowers, yes, they are missing, either in jail or we cannot talk to them at this time because they cannot be found. And our investigation is so important, Steve, that this will bring down the President of the United States, Marjorie Taylor Greene added. Taylor Greene's explanation comes after Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, told Fox News Channel on Sunday that they'd lost contact with at least one key informant. The national broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story. An IRS whistleblower who claims to have information about alleged mishandling and political interference in the ongoing criminal probe into Hunter Biden has been removed from the investigation into the president's son. Attorneys for the whistleblower have told key congressional lawmakers. Attorneys for the whistleblower sent a letter on Monday, 15th of May, to a series of House and Senate committee chairmen informing them of the change, adding that the whistleblower's investigative team has also been taken off the case, according to a copy of the letter obtained by CNN. The attorneys, including Tristan Leavitt, president of Empower Oversight, and Mark Little, added that the whistleblower was informed the change was at the request of the Department of Justice. The letter states that it is an investigation of a high-profile controversial subject, which sources familiar with the matter have previously confirmed to CNN was President's son, Hunter Biden. Federal prosecutors have spent years spanning three attorney general investigating Hunter Biden and have weighed bringing charges against him for alleged tax crimes and a false statement. So far, no charges have been filed. Hunter Biden has denied any wrongdoing. In a statement on Tuesday, 16th of May, the IRS declined to comment on a specific taxpayer matter. In general, the IRS, the Inland Revenue Service, is deeply committed to protecting the role of whistleblowers, and there are robust processes and procedures in place to protect whistleblowers. An IRS commissioner, Danny Werfel, has stated, "We will not tolerate retaliation against any IRS employee making a whistleblower allegation. When suggestions of wrongdoing are raised, we work with all appropriate parties, including the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, to ensure the integrity of the whistleblower process is safeguarded. According to the IRS statement, the department cannot comment on the matter, a Justice Department spokesperson said. As to any investigation of Hunter Biden, as the Attorney General has said, that investigation is being handled by U.S. Attorney David Weiss, who has full authority to make investigative decisions and to bring charges in any jurisdiction as he deems appropriate. An attorney for the IRS whistleblower didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Delaware, the office conducting the Hunter Biden criminal probe, declined to comment. White House spokesman Ian Sams previously said that President Biden has made clear that this matter would be handled independently by the Justice Department under the leadership of a U.S. attorney appointed by former President Trump, free from any political interference by the White House. He has upheld that commitment. Representative Richard Neal, the top Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee, said in a statement, "Ways and Means Democrats take whistleblowers and their protections seriously. More detail is needed here, and we call on Commissioner Werfel to provide the necessary context before making any further judgment," the statement said. The attorneys, Tristan Leavitt and Mark Little, claim in their letter that the move is clearly retaliatory and may also constitute obstruction of a congressional inquiry, a claim that stands in contrast to testimony made by IRS Commissioner Daniel Werfel in April, when he told the House Ways and Means Committee that, "I can say without any hesitation, there will be no retaliation for anyone making an allegation or a call to a whistleblower hotline." The attorneys write that given the agent has successfully sought whistleblower protection, he's protected from retaliatory personnel actions, and that any attempt by any government official to prevent a federal employee from furnishing information to Congress is also a direct violation of long-standing appropriations restriction, and that it is a crime to obstruct an investigation of Congress. The move to sideline the whistleblower and his investigative team comes months after some agents complained that they were no longer being included in some discussions about the case, in part because of alleged leaks, people familiar with the matter told CNN. The investigative work on the case is largely over, and the case awaits charging decision by U.S. Attorney David Weiss, a Donald Trump appointee who is overseeing the probe. The dispute is also not common in fights between Congress and the executive branch of the government over whistleblower complaints. There is no indication the agent in question has lost their job at the IRS. The letter was sent to Democratic and Republican chairmen, as well as the ranking members of the Senate Finance and Judiciary Committees and the House Ways and Means and Judiciary Committees. Attorneys Leavitt and Little asked the committee leaders to give the matter their prompt attention. Republicans and the House Ways and Means Committee confirmed receipts of the letter to CNN, adding in a statement that the most recent communication concerning allegations of retaliatory actions against the whistleblower appears to contradict the sworn testimony by Commissioner Werfel, who pledged that whistleblower protections would be upheld. Congress's duty to hold government agencies accountable relies on the availability and willingness of individuals to speak out about wrongdoing. Not only does retaliation like this discourage whistleblowers, it can also rise to the level of an illegal violation of statutory protections for whistleblowers, the statement continued. CNN has previously reported that the IRS whistleblower alleges that Weiss' ability to bring charges in the case involving Hunter Biden is being thwarted by political appointees. That would contradict promises by Attorney General Merrick Garland in congressional testimony that Attorney Weiss, a Donald Trump appointee, has full authority to make final decisions on whether to prosecute the president's son, Hunter Biden. The IRS whistleblower also claimed to have information that contradicts sworn testimony to Congress by a senior political appointee, according to a previous letter from his attorney. That senior political appointee was Attorney General Merrick Garland. People familiar with the matter have confirmed to CNN. Time magazine has also covered this story and tells us more. The top Republican under House Oversight Committee clarified on Monday that an informant the committee has lost touch with isn't related to the committee's demand that the FBI hand over internal investigative notes about President Joe Biden. House Oversight Chair James Comer is leading an investigation of overseas business transactions by companies he alleges benefited Biden's relatives during and shortly after the years that Biden was vice president. James Comer has so far failed to show how Biden may have benefited from the payments or how any alleged business dealings by relatives may have impacted Biden's policy decisions. He has repeatedly blamed stonewalling by the Biden administration for why his investigation hasn't gotten more traction. Then on Sunday, James Comer made the unusual disclosure to Fox News Channel that his office has lost touch with an informant in the investigation. "Well, unfortunately, we can't track down the informant. We're hopeful the informant is still there," Comer said. The remark led to widespread speculation that the missing informant was related to the Oversight Committee's fight with the FBI over handling over internal investigation notes and demands to know what actions, if any, the FBI took to investigate Joe Biden. It also sparked unfounded conspiracy theories online that Biden's allies have intervened to silence the informant. James Comer's office clarified on Monday that the informant he lost touch with is unrelated to the FBI records the committee is requesting. Jessica Collins, communications director for the House Oversight Committee, told Time magazine in an email that the whistleblower, who has come forward about the FBI record, alleged that then-Vice President Joe Biden engaged in a bribery scheme with a foreign national isn't missing. James Comer was referring to another whistleblower regarding the Biden family's influence peddling schemes, Collins wrote.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The communique has been issued by G7 leaders. Their aim, Russia and China. They took aim at Beijing on issues like the South China Sea, human rights, and alleged interference in their democracies. Well, China has sat back and said, in fact, it is the G7 that is hindering world peace. So who's at fault here? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the G7's controversial communique, which said decisions taken by the G7 are aimed at containing Moscow and Beijing. That's something Russia actually said, using Ukraine as a tool to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia, amongst other issues. First, let me introduce our guest. George Zamioli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, joins us from London. We also have Isha Krishnaswamy, who's a podcaster and journalist, joining us from St. Petersburg.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, George Samueli. Let's look at what the Russian foreign minister has said about this G7 communique. Decisions taken by the group are aimed at the double containment of Russia and China. What does he mean exactly by a double containment?
Well, it's that this very narrow grouping of countries, they are all members of NATO, with the exception of Japan, and Japan is a very close military ally of the United States, obviously. So this very narrow group of countries arrogates to itself the right to rule over the world, to create what it calls the rules-based international order. And who does this group regard as the chief adversaries of this imposed world order? Well, Russia and China. And they, you know, it is quite clear from the very lengthy communique that they issued that they are targeting Russia, obviously, most strongly, but China also. And the communique speaks extensively about China. And it shows, you know, that this very small group of countries regards Russia and China as its chief adversaries.
All right. Ishal, let's take a look at a couple, things that we've drawn out of the communique, which may indicate what Russia meant by this double containment. And I'm wondering what you think. Tightening sanctions against Moscow and then paring back exposure to China. Also urging China to press Russia to halt its military aggression and immediately withdraw its forces from Ukraine. I take back the first part of what I said. Is the double containment meaning that Russia should be pressured by China to halt its military aggression? Is that the double containment just in that aspect?
I don't think so. I think the double containment refers to the West's wishes to limit the ability for either Russia or China to have foreign relations with other countries in the manner that they see fit, because as we've seen from like the West's own admission, the G7's own admission, that they see this as a threat to the existing world order that they created in 1944 with the Bretton Woods Conference, the World Bank, the UN, the IMF. So I think that is what they're referring to. But within this, they see Russia as a threat for various reasons. The first one is because Russia does not really roll over. For example, in 2008, when there was the crisis in Ossetia, they sent their troops. And now, and again in 2013 for Syria and here in Ukraine. So Russia really prevents the G7 countries from exerting their desires on other countries. China, with the Belt and Road Initiative and their economic relations in Africa and Latin America, where they're building much needed infrastructure, is again a threat to the existing way the West does business, which is mostly use Africa and Latin America as a raw materials resource from which they suck resources and purposely impoverish the population. So that is what I think Lavrov is referring to as double containment.
Okay. Let's take a look at why Russia is offended, to say the least. Of course, they get offended every day by the U.S. and the G7 as a whole. But George Samueli, taking a look at what Lavrov has said, first of all, it's one thing for the G7, I guess, to use Ukraine as a tool to inflict, a strategic defeat on Russia. That's one thing. But Lavrov is saying that they openly not only want to defeat Russia on the battlefield, but to eliminate it as a geopolitical competitor. I mean, that sounds like eliminating Russia in a sense, doesn't it?
Oh, no question. When the Russian leaders particularly President Putin, talk about this existential threat to Russia, they have in mind not just the military defeat of Russia in Ukraine, but the destruction of the Russian government and the destruction of the Russian Federation. I mean, the West is going all in. It's trying to essentially finish off the job that it started in 1991 with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. But the West somehow was quite happy with Yeltsin and allowed the Russian Federation to survive more or less intact. This time, the West is playing for keeps, and they want to see the Russian Federation gone. So the stakes are very high for Russia, and I think Lavrov's statement, and he's made many statements like that, indicate that, you know, ultimately Russia cannot afford to lose this, because if they lose this war, they lose their whole state.
When we hear, Isha, how, like our analyst there said, for Russia to be gone, the stance of the EU, or for others in the media perhaps saying for Russia to be gone, you know, when you take a look at that statement, it's beyond actually comprehension as to how Russia can be gone. I mean, you know, you can tell us how that is just not something that is based on reality.
It is not based on reality, because Russia has one of the fiercest militaries in the world, and they have one of the most advanced weapons, and the military and the weapon system works very well, so it is unlikely to happen. But that does not change the fact that the West definitely has plans for this. Earlier this year in January, inside the EU headquarters, they had a meeting about the Federation after Russia, where they were planning some kind of Yugoslavia-like Balkanization project. And in the 1990s, they kind of tried a little bit of that with the Chechenian War. So that is definitely in the plans. And of course, it is very highly unlikely that they will realize this plan. But that does not change the threat to the Russian Federation by the West. And again, in Ukraine, we've had the defense minister say that he wants to target ethnic Russians. And for the past 8 years in the Donbas region, they have been doing that, targeting and endangering ethnic Russians. So there is both a danger for people who speak the Russian language and who identify ethnically as Russian, and also the state itself, if they do not fight back against the aggression posed by the West.
All right. Joyce Amiali, instigating instability, human rights violations, interfering in democracies. Mm-hmm. So who do you think is making that statement, Russia and China against the G7 or G7 against Russia and China? Because if you use the... If you think of the G7, aren't they guilty, the respective countries, particularly the U.S. and the U.K., of committing the same violations as they have indicated against China in this case?
Well, of course, they've been doing this for decades. The United States has been interfering in elections throughout the world. And it's done worse things. I mean, it's organized assassinations, organized coups, instigated military insurgencies in countries all over the world. But because the Western powers assume that they are on the side of good, they're on the side of the angels, therefore it's obviously a good thing when there is a coup somewhere and the bad guys are removed and the United States is behind it. That's not interference. That's just God's will working on Earth. So that's how the West sees it. Now, of course, when any other country seems to be interfering in other countries' affairs, and of course, you know, they don't, you know, they do it about 1/100th of the amount that the Western powers do it, then there is absolute indignation. And we remember the hysteria of Russiagate, which went on for 3 years, in which media personalities and politicians were tearing their hair out, screaming that this is the worst thing since 9/11, the Pearl Harbor, and the Kennedy assassination, Russian interference in the American election. So, yeah, I mean, every time the G7 says these things, I mean, you really have to just take a cool drink.
Well, they're the leading countries, as they claim to be, of the world. Well, Isha, yeah. Another thing that they have voiced, and this is against China, is the militarization in the Asia-Pacific region. And we're not trying to rip apart this communique, but we're trying to understand where they're coming from. So when they talk about China's militarization and how that they think peace and stability should prevail, especially when it comes to the Taiwan Strait, isn't the U.S. the one, however, that's selling military equipment to countries like Taiwan? And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Japan for the first time to have unveiled a record budget, for its defense, 20% rise in military sales, of which obviously Gesu provides the military equipment to Japan. So who's at fault here?
I would have to say definitely the U.S. First of all, we have to understand how Taiwan got created. It was Chiang Kai-shek's army that basically, when the People's Liberation Army chased them, they fled to Taiwan, and the PLA did not really have a navy, and the U.S. Navy blockaded the region, so that's kind of how Taiwan exists. And both Taiwan and China recognize the One China policy. They just defer on when and how the reunification is going to happen. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, if we look at a map, it's in the South China Sea, and China has every right to defend its ports in the South China Sea. And I have no idea what the U.S. is doing all the way across the Pacific Ocean. And on top of it, the U.S. is also saber-rattling and trying to move the microchip industry out of Taiwan. And they are also militarizing Taiwan. And they were also involved in a color revolution involving the DPP party because the KMT became too soft for them. They wanted to do reunification and start negotiating the Tente with China. So I would say it's definitely U.S. is at fault. And China has been doing some sea drills with Russia in the Pacific, but that is a response to the U.S. Navy floats that are humongous, and they're in Samoa, they're in Marshall Islands. So I would definitely, just looking at a map and counting the distance between China and the South China Sea versus the U.S., shows you who's at fault here.
All right, and I'm going to have to also get your take on this, George Samioli, because this is pretty important. Because last time we checked, the U.S. is provoking China in many different ways. There's been plenty of, alarm bells going off that there's a coming war with China. Not to mention the fact that we're looking at how North Korea, in a sense, is reacting the way it is towards the joint military exercises that the U.S. has held time and again with South Korea and also with Japan. Perhaps they're not looking for a solution there, because that will keep there at least a reason to give the U.S. Justification for its presence there. So that's all leads to instability. Isn't that something that the G7 countries take a note of when they're issuing this in their communique?
Well, they should take a note of it, but of course they don't. I mean, because for them, China is just an aggressor state. You know, they're inexplicably doing these terrible things because they're a terrible country, a terrible regime. But of course, you're absolutely right. And what the United States is doing in Taiwan, and they say it explicitly, is pursuing what they call a porcupine strategy. In other words, they keep pouring arms into Taiwan and making it quite a strong, effective military power, so that should there arise a problem, for instance, for China, they've already said the red line for them is if Taiwan declares independence. In other words, if Taiwan declares independence, they would have to resort to military action. They don't want to do it, but that's the red line. Well, if they pursue this, Americans help pursue this porcupine strategy, then that military action is going to become very, very difficult. And so what the Americans are doing in Taiwan is similar to what they were doing in Ukraine. I mean, they're building it up, until the point when Russia was just really was back against the wall and say, well, we can't allow this. We can't allow this armed aircraft carrier on our borders, absolutely rabidly hostile to us with its guns pointing at us. We need to take action. And that could well happen in Taiwan. I mean, the more it gets built up as a formidable military power, the more the Chinese are going to decide we have to do something now before it's too late.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, so we have about, I think, 17 minutes that we've torn apart the G7 in some sense. So let's look at one of the bright spots here, Esha. And it was something that von der Leyen said, of which she said it's been described as a PG2. It's an initiative of $600 billion, which sounds like a great amount of money for what she has referred to as top-quality infrastructure, where Europe is proud to contribute half of it. I mean, this sounds great, right? But I'm wondering where the $300 billion is going to come from, while at the same time you have Europeans that are suffering so much from a cost of living crisis that they're out on the streets at least on a weekly basis. That kind of goes against their own economies, how people are suffering there. Why wouldn't she want to invest that kind of money in the countries of the EU?
Because we've already determined the EU is a currency union that is based on austerity, and it is a way to enact austerity, privatization, on all the things that purposely impoverish the people. Today, I just read a report that at least 30% of France is now food insecure. And this is the first time in a long time where this has happened. And so, of course, the entire purpose of the EU is to take away monetary sovereignty from the countries and their ability to develop programs for their own citizens and to force them into the Eurozone, where they're forced into austerity, like what happened with Greece and what is soon to happen with Italy and Spain. So, it just goes counter to the design of the EU to actually use it to improve the lives of their own citizens. And as for the infrastructure project, I'm very skeptical of what kind of infrastructure they plan on using and what their plans are, because it seems like they haven't been able to do the infrastructure like China or Iran. It just remains to be seen if they are modern and competitive in the 21st century.
Okay, let's move on to the whole issue that they have stressed on, and that is no Chinese decoupling, George Samueli. Based on the communique, it said to coordinate our approach to economic resilience and economic security that is based on diversifying, deepening partnerships, and de-risking, not decoupling. So if they don't want to decouple from China, then why are they pushing to decouple from China?
Yes. That's exactly right. This is the line that they've been taking. They borrowed it from what they've been saying on Russia. So, we've got to eliminate our dependence on Russia. Now, they still keep buying stuff from Russia. They keep, they still buy oil, they still buy gas, they still buy food, everything else from Russia, precious metals, diamonds, gold, everything. They're still buying it. But they say, we are going to cut back on it. We're going to slowly but surely we're going to get less and less and less and less. So that's what they're now trying to do on China as well. We're going to cut back on everything, that all our dependence on China. And, and we would say, look, I mean, it's perfectly reasonable that powers should eliminate their economic dependence on anyone. I mean, you should be self-sufficient to the best of your abilities. But that's not really what's going on here, because, of course, when you look at the EU is becoming a wholly owned subsidiary of the United States. So you may be decoupling from China, but you are not decoupling from the United States. So you're basically... Europe will become wholly dependent on energy imports from the United States, the liquefied natural gas. And, their economies are going to be shipped from the EU, where it's much too expensive, to the United States. And that will be that. That will be that as far as Europe being any kind of an economic power. So, all the talk about, decoupling from China, yeah, but you're in a much worse position than you were before. You are now wholly dependent on the United States.
Indeed. So my final question goes to you, Isha. We have also the G7 that has issued a very strong condemnation on China when it comes to economic threat posed by China. I'm not too sure how that really pans out in their thoughts. But they said that they need to untangle sensitive supply chains from Chinese influence. Now, there's two points here that I can bring up as examples. When it says that they China should be out of the equation when it comes to supply chains, well, wasn't it the U.S. the one that blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that led to a supply chain being disrupted there? And also when it comes to an economic threat, isn't the U.S. at risk of a default in their country of over $31 trillion, which could lead to a worldwide economic recession, or at a minimum, for there to be a negative economic impact on the world financially?
The answer is yes to both. So with the supply chain, it is in the 90s, it was Bill Clinton who decided to deindustrialize the U.S., and many companies chose China because back then China had a policy that was easy to create manufacturing there. And so it is kind of the West's own doing that China is involved in the supply chain of so many different industries. But China also has about 1.4 billion people. So it is very hard for anybody in the world to decouple from China. As for the supply chain, yes, the US blew up the Nord Stream. And on top of that, they're the ones who are enforcing sanctions upon Syria, Iran, North Korea, Russia, that really have the deleterious effect on the supply chain. For example, I was speaking to a man who worked at the shipyard here in St. Petersburg, and he was telling me how it is hard for them to build ships because certain parts come from Norway and other parts come from Japan, and they just can't get it. So a lot of them have been, shipping industry has been really hurt. So the West